Those of you who receive and read the e-memo this week, I know they are not one and the same, will maybe remember that one of the things that's going on this summer is that we're going to be looking at the stories of the Hebrew Bible, aka the whole Old Testament. We're going to be looking at stories of women from the Hebrew Bible. And you might already know, because the title of my little reflection this week was content warning, that some of these stories are not necessarily safe for work. At least most of the stories contain some level of family drama or violence, and at the very least sort of like nighttime soap opera levels of like intrigue and drama. And some of the threads of the story today literally have woven their way into the popular streaming series Handmaid's Tale, which I didn't watch, but I've read the book. And most recently, there's a graphic novel that has been made of The Handmaid's Tale, which I really enjoyed. And I assume that what's the same in the streaming series as is in the novel and as is in our story is that wealthy women who are unable to bear children use the bodies of surrogates, of handmaids, literally bringing them ritually into their marriage beds to conceive. And one of the things that I appreciate about Margaret Atwood's take on this story, on this book, is that it is told from the viewpoint of the handmaid. It's told from the viewpoint of the woman who doesn't have privilege, who does not even have a name, whose body is not her own, and who is sort of forced to do this thing with her body. She's forced to use it in that way. So culturally, we're sort of disposed to dislike the other woman. We're disposed to disdain that person as the one who breaks up the marriage, who breaks up the band, who leads to the downfall of everything that is good and right. But culturally in the Hebrew Bible and in this story, it was not uncommon for families to have surrogates, for families to have multiple wives. We can feel how we want to feel about marriages that have multiple partners or polyamory or whatever. That's not what this is. This is culturally an appropriate way to bear children. It was part of custom and culture. And that's just how it was done. But it was no wonder that Sarah, who I don't love how she acts in this story either. It's not great. Driving her young and pregnant slave into the desert, not once but twice. Well, the second time it's the woman and her child. It is not a good look for Sarah or for Abraham, who is just like, yeah, do what you want. You know, she's your slave. Sarah is the one with the spouse. She's the one with the resources. She has explicitly received God's blessing, and yet that's sort of also what puts her in this position that she's in. God has told her she is going to bear children, that they are going to have many offsprings, and so she's desperate. I was just talking with Carol this morning about her granddaughter who struggled to conceive, and I had that experience too, and it's excruciating every time you think, oh, maybe it's this time. And Sarah has received that promise and yet nothing, and she is desperate. She can't possibly see how it would come to pass. So she takes things into her own hands. The problem is, taking the situation into her own hands for Sarah doesn't mean fertilizing eggs in a test tube or paying a person that the fertility clinic recruits to have a baby for you. It means forcing a sexual relationship between a young enslaved person and her husband. It is no wonder that when Hagar then becomes pregnant, she starts feeling jealous and resentful. She feels threatened. Meanwhile, Hagar still has no power, no agency, and absolutely no protection. Sarah lashes out at Abraham when she's starting to feel these feelings of anger and jealousy, and she's like, it's all your fault this is happening. And then immediately followed by, I allowed you to embrace my servant. So whose fault is it? I don't, but they're both, they're all three of those, these people, they're in a really stuck and terrible position. Last week, Catherine, when she preached, quoted the trans writer and activist Skylar Baylor, who said, the problem is not cis straight men. The problem is patriarchy. It's true now. It was true for the patriarchs. The problem is not Abraham or even Sarah, although she was the one to take the action. There is this expectation of the culture, and explicitly told to them by God, that this is how families look. And it's so important to continue the line. It's to have children. And Hagar is the one who then gets caught at the intersection of all of those expectations. 30 odd years ago, the scholar Kimberly Crenshaw coined the term intersectionality to describe that experience of identity, of being caught at the middle of multiple ways of understanding, multiple identities. Lots of people have heard of this idea by now, particularly in the last decade or so of uprising for Black lives. But Crenshaw's work describes this of intersectionality, describes the idea that a person or individual's social and individual identities combine, or they intersect, to contribute to the unique experiences of both discrimination and privilege. Her work in particular emerged as a way to describe the particular and unique experiences of both sexism and anti-Black racism experienced by Black women. Now, Hagar didn't have that word, but she did have this experience. She sat at the intersection of being enslaved, of being a woman, a girl almost, really, when this story begins. It's striking to me that Abraham and Sarah are 86 or something when this story starts, but Hagar must be, you know, maybe a teenager even. She's young, very, very young. So that's another, you know, age also maybe is in there. She's an immigrant. And for this reason, her story has resonated with Black women for centuries, since Harriet Tubman was bringing people out of the wilderness of slavery. And around the same time that Kimberly Crenshaw was publishing her first work about intersectionality, another scholar, Dolores Williams, was doing work around the story of Hagar and Sarah and beginning to write about the ways that Hagar's story was aligning with the experiences of Black women. Williams says in the introduction to her book, Sisters in the Wilderness, even today, most of Hagar's situation is congruent with many African-American women's predicaments of poverty, sexual and economic exploitation, surrogacy, domestic violence, homelessness, rape, motherhood, single parenting, ethnicities, and meetings with God. That is an astonishing sentence to me. This list of oppressions that culminates with encounters with God. Hagar is driven into the wilderness twice, and twice she experiences profound encounters with God. The times when she is most at crisis, God appears to her. In the first instance, Hagar is pregnant and she is hopeless, and she's run away what seems to her like an impossible situation. She probably thinks she is going to die and that maybe that is better than the situation that she is in. And God finds her. And really what I want to happen in this story is God says to her, be free. Here are all the resources that you need to be free. I'm giving you everything that you have. Get out of that terrible house. That is really what I want to happen. That's not what happens. Instead, God tells her to go back. So I'm going to back up just a smidge to say the context of this story, it might have been astonishing to Sarah and Abraham that God appeared to say to Hagar at all, that God would appear to this slave, this foreigner. And not only does God appear to Hagar in this moment, but they have kind of like a face-to-face, almost like appearance of like a a mutual engagement in which God sees Hagar truly for what she is, and Hagar sees God. And by the way, anytime you see like God's messenger, that kind of language in the Bible, God's messenger says, yada, yada, that's basically a synonymous with seeing God. All of those things that just mean when they say God's messenger spoke or God's messenger appeared, that is like an equal sign to God appeared. So they have this face-to-face encounter in which Hagar gives God a name. She says, "You are El Roy," which can mean God who sees and also the God who is seen. So there's this like kind of back and forth that happened. And not only is God seen and does God see, but God blesses. Another astonishing thing that Hagar, a foreign, young slave woman with nothing, receives exactly the same kind of blessing that Abraham the patriarch receives. The same kind of promise that Abraham received. Even Sarah hasn't had her own encounter with the divine at this point. God comes first to Hagar with blessing and this assurance that she too will have so many descendants that they cannot be counted. But God tells her to go back. To go back. It's heartbreaking that God tells her to go back, and it's heartbreaking that it must have been heartbreaking to her to hear that, to know that for her survival, she must return to the place that is harming her. The God who sees wants her to survive so that she can ultimately find liberation, both for herself and for Ishmael. God doesn't fix the situation, but God comes alongside to offer companionship in heartbreak. The idea of coming alongside, of being Hagar's companion in her darkest moments, made me think about the work of a pastor who has worked with unhoused people in Seattle for decades. He's retired now, but maybe you have heard of Craig Rennebaum because he's kind of known for his work in this area. He developed the idea of mental health chaplaincy in his work with folks, particularly in Pioneer Square and downtown Seattle. And one of the primary tools that Craig Rennebaum uses when he's reaching out to people who are unhoused and who are at that intersection of mental health crisis and homelessness is what he calls companioning. He's not trying to fix. He's not trying to offer resources. It is coming alongside. And so when I heard it explained to me now many years ago, the image that was used was both literally like a sitting or standing behind a person who is in crisis or who is homeless, or maybe even walking a little ways together. And so that's sort of the image of what this kind of relationship is with folks. But it's also literally the approach to take that is non-confrontational, that is open, that allows an exit for someone who might be feeling a little threatened. So it's literally that, and it is also this attitude in relationship that by coming alongside, we are for a little space of time facing the same direction. We see the same things. We're looking at the world in the same way. We can offer support, can listen without having to confront, without having to debate or fix. What I wonder as I read the story of Hagar in the wilderness is that even though I desperately want God to be a liberator, just right out of the gate, to fix everything for Hagar, God is more like a companion coming alongside. And that is more akin not to evening soap operas, but to what our lives are like. And when we experience pain, when we experience suffering or oppression, God comes alongside and sees. God sees us. Especially in these Hebrew Bible stories, the lives of our ancestors in faith are just as complicated as our lives are now. And there's not necessarily a lesson. And there's not necessarily a neat and tidy ending. And in among that complicated story, I try to ask myself, so where is the good news? Where is the gospel in this story? And where is their invitation? And I believe it is exactly in that, coming alongside, both as God is companion to those who are most vulnerable, who are most harmed, that God sees. And I believe God comes alongside each one of us in our crisis and is inviting us to do the same. I see that happening already in this congregation, I must say, of the way all of y'all approach relationship to those who are hurting. And I invite us, as God invites us, to continue offering what we can for the time that we can. May we see God with us, and may we be God in the world. Amen.